It's the last Thursday in Pride Month, and we're talking about Some Like It Hot, which is maybe the best comedy of all time. We'll get into that debate when we start. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies.
I love this trailer so much. Because there's not a lot of exposition, which I'm so used to from modern day trailers,
right?
Of like, this summer, biggest thing ever.
So yeah.
Not since the Marx Brothers, so much comedy. Not since the 7-year itch, so much Maryland. The best picture this year will also
one
be
of my
the
favorite
funniest.
Scenes.
Good night, sugar.
Good night, honey.
There's one thing sure, boy never met girl like this before. You've never laughed more at sex or a picture about it.
You stay here as long as you like.
Jack may have beaten Tony to the sugar, but not for long.
You're not giving yourself a chance. Don't fight it. Relax.
And her bosom companions.
Hear Marilyn sing the fabulous songs of the Roaring Twenties on the United Artists soundtrack album.
Running wild, lost control, running wild, mighty bold, feeling gay, reckless too. Carefree mind all the time, never blue. Always going, don't know where. Always showing, I don't care. Don't love nobody, it's not worthwhile. All alone, running wild.
Oh my God.
So good.
Love performances. What's up, guys? Welcome to the Knife Hour. I had to start with that trailer because I think it sets the perfect tone. If you haven't seen Some Like It Hot, if you don't know what the greatness of this movie is about, I feel like that's maybe a really great introduction. We are, of course, welcoming back Peter Rayner, film extraordinaire, film critic, to talk to us about this film and break down some of the history for us. How are you doing today, Peter?
Great. How are you doing, guys?
Good.
Really good. I want to start with Jack Lemmon and Tony Curtis,
yeah.
Because the dynamic duo, so great. What was this film like for them getting, or I guess, where were their careers at before joining this picture?
Well, Tony Curtis had started out as a sort of archetypal pretty boy in the movies. He was in a lot of not very good movies, but he was there because of, you know, how he looked. It is not true that in this film that he did with Piper Laurie, set in Arabia, that he utters the line, "Yonder is the castle of my father." but he had a thick Bronx accent. He was, his Bernie Schwartz was his real name. Bernie Schwartz.
Wow.
And but he had at this point become a real actor in films like A Sweet Smell of Success, with Burt Lancaster, and Trapeze, also with Lancaster, that the great Carol Reed directed, and The Defiant Ones, that he was nominated for an Oscar for that film with Sidney Poitier. So when he made Some Like It Hot, he was not only just there for his looks, but because he had given some rather startlingly good performances, given that everyone thought he was a kind of, you know, no talent for a long time leading up to that. Mm-hmm. Jack Lemmon had, you know, been very acclaimed for films like Mr. Roberts, and he also was on his way to being a very versatile and extraordinary actor, both in drama and comedy. So they had a career that was, both of them, well on its way by the time they made this film in 1959. Now, Marilyn Monroe, do you want to talk about that, too?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, she had you know, sort of a very celebrated career. So she started out in, you know, bit roles in movies where she was recognized in films like The Asphalt Jungle and All About Eve. And then she kind of graduated to more featured roles as, you know, dumb blondes in a lot of films. But she was given a lot of good reviews for films like Bus Stop, based on a famous Inge play that Josh Logan directed and so forth. And she had appeared in a film with Laurence Olivier, no less, that Olivier directed, The Prince and the Showgirl.
That's the movie that they made a movie about recently with...
Yeah, right, right.
Well, I can't remember the girl who played her name, but yeah.
Yeah, it was Eddie Redmayne was a... about the
My
making
Week
of
with
that
Marilyn,
movie.
Yes.
Yeah, so, you know, they... But by the time she did Some Like It Hot, she had a reputation for being, you know, very difficult on the set, very hard to work with, never remembered her lines. She had been through a celebrated brief marriage to Joe DiMaggio, mm-hmm. and she was married to Arthur Miller. Mm-hmm. She had moved back east and had studied in this, with Strasberg, and a lot of the method people were according to Billy Wilder, sort of interfering with his direction of her on the set of Some Like It Hot. So it was a great big mess. When she married Arthur Miller, by the way, it was a classic headline in Variety saying Egghead weds Hourglass.
Oh, boy. No.
Oh, wow.
So they were all very much, I think, at or near the height of their careers, certainly as far as the men go, in terms of performance by the time this film came out.
I really enjoyed the musical numbers. Does she always sing in her films? I mean, I haven't seen very many Marilyn Monroe films.
She's in a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, she sang in Bus Stop. She sang in, you know,
How to Marry a Millionaire.
Okay. And
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Right, okay, exactly. So yeah. You know, with Jane Russell. So she, yeah. I mean, she didn't have the world's greatest voice, but like everything else about Monroe, there was something, you know, undefinable about her that was better than actors who were more skilled, who had right. better voices and everything else. She just had that X factor.
Why don't we pull up that Monroe clip of her dancing? Because I think the train scene for a lot of people is incredibly memorable. It's I mean, we have the gaggle of girls scene in a ton of movies, but there's something about women who aren't so polite in the 50s in a black and white movie doing it that's kind of rare. And then, of course, Marilyn is just showing herself out here.
Lost control, running wild, mighty bold, feeling gay, reckless too. Carefree mind all the time, never blue. Always going, don't know where. Always showing, I don't care. Don't love nobody, it's not worthwhile. All alone.
That walk, though.
Running wild.
And she drops the flask.
Beanstalk!
Sue, what is
it? I thought I made it perfectly clear that I don't want any drinking in this outfit.
All right, girls, who does this belong to? Come on now, speak up. Sugar, I warn you.
Please, Mr. Beanstalk.
This is the last straw. In Kansas City, you were smuggling liquor in a shampoo bottle. Before that, I caught you with a pint in your ukulele.
Mr. Beanstalk, could I have my flask, please?
Sure, thanks. Pack your things. The next station we come... Your flask?
Yes, just a little bourbon. Must have slipped through.
Give me.
Didn't you girls say you went to a conservatory?
Oh, yes, for a whole year.
I thought you said 3 years.
We got time off. For good behavior.
There are two things that I will not put up with during working hours. One is liquor, and the other one is men.
Men? Oh, you don't have to worry about that. We wouldn't be caught dead with men. Rough, hairy beasts. Eight men. And they all just want one thing from a girl. I beg your pardon.
His eyes.
All right, girls.
So
what
good.
What I like about Jack and Tony is, I guess they were saying that Jack picked his kind of characterization of a woman first, and he went with the big, kind of very silly girl. And then Tony was like, well, I'll play the opposite. I'll play the very reserved, refined, thinking of the correct words, maybe more put together woman.
Softer, yeah. Maybe?
Yes, nice. Very good.
Well, they both sort of wanted to play it out there, but since Jack Lemmon was so adamant about doing that, and he was so good at it, that I think, you know, Tony Curtis and Billy Wilder felt that you can't have two people who are acting the way Jack Lemmon is in his film. So Tony Curtis went in the completely other direction. You know, it was a sort of lady of quality and, you know, a grand dame and someone who wasn't at all ditzy the way Jack Lemmon was. It should be pointed out that Jack Lemmon went to Harvard, and there's a club called the Hasty Pudding Club in Harvard that's basically all men in drag doing shows. And he was the president of the Hasty Pudding Club. And I've seen a few of their productions. They're very funny, and but the roles are all the women's roles are played by men. So this wasn't a total stretch for Jack Lemmon, given the fact that, you know, he had been the president of that club and had acted in all these productions, you know, when he was in college. What I like about his performance, one of the many things I like about his performance in this film is that he really seems to totally get into the idea of being a woman while also standing apart from it somehow. You know what I mean? I mean,
he never gives up his privilege as a man in becoming a woman. Like, he expects the same reactions, where I think Tony plays more into the, like, he understands how women are going to be treated and kind of reacts accordingly, whereas Jack's character is very in your face.
Well, whenever Jack is with Marilyn, it's clear that he's a man because he's constantly trying to somehow not, you know, get all over her, but
when he's
in the scenes with Joey Brown, though, you know, Osgood, the millionaire who's fixated on her, it's different. I mean, he sort of is getting into the idea of being a woman who doesn't want to be hit on by this guy, and it's very complicated.
Yeah, the Catholic Church had a moral. They were saying, I can't remember the words. Hold on. Morally objectionable is the title they gave the film.
Hayes Office.
No, this is from the Roman Catholic Church.
The Legion of Decency.
Yes. That they said it was, they didn't outright ban it, which definitely could have been a thing that happened. I know Ohio banned it, and in Memphis it was rated adults only. And then And then as you just mentioned, the Hayes Code kind of breaks because of this movie. Can you first explain what the Hayes Code is?
Well, the Hayes Code was started in, I think, 1930 as a way for the industry to police itself. There was a guy, Will Hayes, who was the head of the production office at the time, and so it was, you know, like Obamacare, the Hayes Code, but it was a way of having the industry police itself as opposed to the government stepping in. So it was one of these sort of lesser of two evil things where they thought that, you know, but they had a whole list of things that they weren't crazy about, including, you know, adultery, murder, disrespect for the law, miscegenation for a long time, you know, a lot of things that were really, you know, and then the Legion of Decency was, you know, a Catholic organization that sort of piggybacked on the Hayes Code people. And between the two of them, it was very hard to do anything in the movies that was at all, you know.
The Hayes Code had rules, like you couldn't say like virgin and like baby or mother in the same sentence.
No, it was ridiculous.
Like
you could, you could pregnant, you know. I mean, you could, there were a lot of words you couldn't say. You had to sleep in separate beds if you were married. Now, having said that, so United Artists, which you know made something like it hot, they released the film without a production code imprimatur. The Legion of Decency, you know, the joke was always that it was the industry was predominantly owned by Jews, kowtowing to a Roman Catholic list of demands, for an audience of Protestant Americans. So, you know, it was complicated. But I do want to say that as much as I decry censorship and think that 98% of these strictures were ridiculous, particularly if you look at the pre-code movies from before the 30s, where you had, you know, nudity, adultery, all sorts of things, you know, the law doesn't always win out. Those are very interesting movies because they were doing a lot of things that they were sort of prohibited or self-censored from doing later on. But Casablanca, for instance, the ending of Casablanca is one of the great endings. If Bogart was prohibited from going off with Ingrid Bergman, that would have been adultery. And yet, because he doesn't do that, it's a very memorable ending.
What?
You know?
This is shocking.
In the famous kissing scene in Alfred Hitchcock's Notorious, Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman, if you recall that, it's a really sexy, great scene. She's pursuing him, but they don't kiss for more than about 5 seconds at a time, because that was kind of the rule. You couldn't hold a kiss for more than like 3 seconds in the movies.
Oh, wow.
So they got around it by having, you know, like 3 seconds, all right, then 3 seconds, and 3 seconds.
Wow.
The Postman Always Rings Twice, with John Garfield and Lana Turner, is a really sexy movie. I think more so than the much more flagrantly sexual version that came out with Jack Nicholson and Jessica Lange. Again, I think censorship sort of, but in general, these were ridiculous rules that by the time Some Like It Hot came out, they just said, well, you know, because one of the things that worked against the Hays Office, the rise of television, you needed reasons to get people into the movie theaters, right? And the TV, the rules on TV were even weirder and stricter than in the movies. Mm. So they had to do something to get people back into the theaters. Also, there was a Supreme Court ruling about, I won't get into it, but foreign films were much more prevalent in the movies in the 50s and 60s in the theaters than they were before that. And those films were under no obligation to do anything to toe the line for any production code.
So did Hays Code then become the modern day movie ratings?
Sort of. I mean, the rating system kind of supplanted the Hays Code.
Okay.
As a way to keep the government out of censoring Hollywood movies. You know, you didn't want the states to say each state would have their own rule. It was very complicated. But in 68, 69, when the rating system kicked in, that sort of supplanted the Hays Code. But even then you had a lot of issues. There were things you couldn't say in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which was one of the first ratings films to come along. You couldn't say screw. They had to replace that in Edward Albee's play. But you could say hump the hostess for some reason. That's in the movie.
This is crazy. And so Some Like It Hot is breaking all kinds of taboos, including, I read some of the complaints against the movie. And it's like it promotes gayness and transvestitism, I think is what they were calling it at the time. And they employed a groundbreaker, Barbette, who was born as Vanderclyde. It was a female impersonator who coached Jack and Tony throughout. Babette winds up being an aerialist trainer at Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey. And some consider him the inspiration for Victor and Victoria. It's just crazy to me that someone like Barbette could be hired by the Hollywood studio system at this time and did more than just this film. You said maybe Tony didn't need it, but I feel like what Curtis was able to come out of was directly influenced by what Barbette was doing, and that same kind of the walks are similar if you watch videos of like Barbette and stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, what kind of impact overall did Barbette have in the industry, or I guess maybe even more specifically on Some Like It Hot?
You know, I don't know that much about the history of him, but I know that the fact that he was hired to, you know, was on the payroll, the movie company payroll to do this, was just sort of an explicit version of what was often the case in Hollywood anyway. You know, the fact that there was so much prohibitive in Hollywood movies in regards to gay themes, and yet so many of the people who worked on the films, who did everything on these films, you know, was gay. It was Ori Kelly designed the dresses for this movie, who is a famous, you know, costume designer and was in demand by all the major players. Jack Lemmon said, "I don't want to just have hand-me-down clothing off the rack," which was what the initial idea was. He says, "No, you know, Marilyn Monroe's getting dressed by Ori Kelly, and everybody's got, you know, that we want to say, you know, we're women, you know." So they
have
got
a picture of Ori Kelly
Billy
dressing
Wilder agreed.
Marilyn, if you want to pull that one up. And why wouldn't they? They look amazing, and they I think that gave them more of a feminine air than perhaps just something off the rack would have. And their makeup kind of played into that, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
They were experimenting a lot with how much they were putting on and how that was going to work.
Right. I mean, this was actually part of the acting process, and not so much for the method, but actors like Olivier and others always felt that to get into character, costume is extremely important. You know, you become your character through the clothing that you wear. And so what better opportunity to do that than in this movie with these guys? You know, I mean, they want to wear the clothes that really puts them totally into the idea of being, you know, feminine, being women, not just some hand-me-down off-the-rack stuff to pay lip service to the fact that they're female impersonators in this film.
Right.
I mean, one of the wonderful things about Lemmon's performance is that he really does get into the idea of being a woman. I mean, he's sort of has convinced himself in some way that this is who he is.
Yeah.
Let's take a look at, this is their first transformation when you see them on screen. These locks kill me.
Florida Limited leaving on track one for one.
You can see how they are decided on the type of woman they want to be, even in this shot.
Yeah, absolutely. Silly girl with the floppy hat, leopard print, opposed to all black and white with her collar. Very classy.
What's the matter now?
How do they walk in these things? Huh? How do they keep their balance?
It must be the way the weight is distributed. Now, come on.
It is so drafty. They must be catching cold all the time.
Well, you quit stalling, we're going to miss the train.
I feel naked. I feel like everybody's staring at me.
With those legs, are you crazy? Now, come on.
It's no use. We're not going to get away with it, Joe.
My name is Josephine, and this was your idea in the first place.
How she moves. That's just like Jell-O on springs. Must have some sort of built-in motor or something. I tell you, it's a whole different sex.
What are you afraid of? Nobody's asking you to have a baby. To get us out of town. Once we get the flower, we'll blow this whole set up.
Joe, this time I am not going to let you talk me into something that...
Okay, that's good. what I like about this moment, too, is that it kind of mimics a real-life moment they have, or at least a rumor that Billy Wilder sends them into a women's restroom dressed in costume to see if they could pass.
Yeah.
That's incredible and terrifying, I would imagine.
Yeah.
I also heard that this movie was supposed to be shot in color, but because the makeup looked
garish,
a little... Yes, so they decided to do black
and
white.
That's true.
So cool.
That's true.
That is incredible. Let's talk a little bit about Billy Wilder, who has this incredible career, incredible run of films. The Apartment is one of my favorite movies of all time. And he kind of, in the focus and themes of his films, is always pushing way past what was maybe acceptable at the time. And
trying to... pushed it.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I also feel like maybe he was kind of a little bit mean to Marilyn. Marilyn, as you were saying earlier, had a reputation for not showing up on time, and she didn't always trust Billy's direction notes. She would refer to her acting coach. But in 1959, he said about filming the movie with Marilyn, "I have discussed this with my doctor and my psychiatrist, and they tell me I'm too old and too rich to go through this again. My Aunt Minnie would always be punctual and never hold up production, but who would pay to see my Aunt Minnie?" So, I mean, maybe not totally cruel, but I don't know. Was treating your actress, was Marilyn kind of that disposable?
He had directed her once before in The 7 Year Itch, a couple of years before. This is, you know, the famous iconic moment when her dress, she's standing over a subway grate, and her dress fluffs up, and, you know, Tom Mule. I guess it's easy to say that he was not terribly wonderful in some of the things that he said about her. On the other hand, you know, when you have 47 takes of her saying it's me, sugar, and she's not getting the line straight, it's sugar, me, it's, but, you know, I mean, literally, that can drive anybody up the wall.
Sure.
And it drove everybody on the set crazy, including Tony Curtis, who had rumored to have had an affair with her some years before. You know, he was quoted as saying kissing Marilyn Monroe in this movie was like kissing Hitler.
Oh,
you know?
Man.
But I think at the end of the day, this is maybe her best movie and her best Marilyn persona altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Billy Wilder was a notorious cynic and notoriously caustic about just about everything. You know, when Ernst Lubitsch, his mentor, for whom he co-wrote Ninotchka, which was Billy Wilder's big breakthrough in Hollywood with Garbo, when Lubitsch died, he was quoted as saying, you know, says it's, I think he was talking with William Wyler, and he said it's terrible. You know, no more Ernst Lubitsch. And Wilder said, even worse, no more Ernst Lubitsch movies. You know, Wilder was a very complicated guy who, you know, started out. He was born in Poland. He worked in Austria. He escaped Hitler by going to France. His mother and several of his close relatives were murdered by the Nazis.
Wow.
In Hollywood, he was supervising, right after the war in 45, there was a documentary that he supervised of the liberation of the concentration camps.
Wow.
Yeah, which was, you know, which was done for the Germans to show them what the Nazis had done. He did The Lost Weekend, which was a classic movie about an alcoholic that got Ray Milland an Oscar for Best Picture. He had done a lot of different kinds of movies. Double Indemnity is my favorite film noir with Fred McMurray. He did all kinds of movies in all different styles, and Sunset Boulevard. He made classics in many different genres before doing Some Like It Hot. Ace in the Hole was a film with Kirk Douglas, which was one of the most black and cynical films about the press and the exploitation of people for ratings, the equivalent of ratings in those days. So he, you know, he didn't suffer fools gladly.
Did any of his boundary pushing get him in trouble with Hollywood? I mean, he's bringing back old stars for Sunset Boulevard that most thought would never work again. He's, you know, talking openly about abortion and contraceptive in a couple of his movies.
Yeah.
Does this ever earn him any pushback? Or I know McCarthy era comes right after this.
He had a complicated relationship with the Huac-McCarthy era. He and John Huston were virtually the only directors who stood up against the idea that you had to have a loyalty oath at that time in the DGA. On the other hand, he was rather cruel to the Hollywood Ten, and you know, they were the quote unfriendly witnesses. And there was a famous quote of Billy Wilder saying, you know, only two of the Hollywood Ten are talented; the rest are just unfriendly.
Damn.
You know. He was a complicated guy.
Did he have a lot of friends?
He had a lot of friends. He was extremely popular in the business because he was so funny. He was such a wit. His screenwriting partner for many years was Charles Brackett, who did, you know, with him Lost Weekend and many other films. You know, he was already on his way to doing mostly comedies by the time he did Some Like It Hot. But he had a falling out or something with Brackett, and then I.E.L. Diamond, who co-wrote Some Like It Hot, came along. And their first film together was Love in the Afternoon with Gary Cooper and Audrey Hepburn. Can I talk a little bit about...
Please.
I.E.L. Diamond, I had always heard about him growing up because my dad went to college in the same class with him at Columbia University. And since I was a big movie nut kid, it was like, wow, you knew. And he said, yeah, I knew Izzy. You know, his real name was something Romanian, but he came to America when he was a kid. He was a math genius. The IAL actually stands for Interscholastic Algebra League.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's right. That's funny.
And he was the editor of the Columbia Spectator, which was the college newspaper, and also wrote all the varsity shows. And I have copies of all of those shows that he wrote when, you know, on back in the day. And those are the shows that got him noticed by the Samuel Goldwyn talent scouts, brought him to Hollywood. And my dad used to did some of his notes in the math class because he was so busy writing the varsity shows so I feel like in some very small way my family is partly responsible for Some Like It Hot.
Oh, absolutely. My gosh. That's amazing.
And I met Diamond years later when he was, you know, when I was out here, and he had the personality of an accountant. Or some, I mean, he was very low key, very not wisecracky. Wilder was the exact opposite, which is probably why they worked so well together. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was kind of the Diamond had done some journeyman work for various studios. He did some writing for Danny Kaye, and he has a credit on a Bob Hope film. But I understand it, he wrote one of the comedy sketches for the Writers Guild show one year, and Wilder saw it and said, "This is very funny. Who is this guy?" And he was looking for a new collaborator, and that's how they got together on Love in the Afternoon.
Wow. Let's take a look at the elevator for Billy Wilder that we pulled, because I feel like this is some really great writing and directing here, exploring... you know, maybe what it's like to step into a female's role for the first time.
Pardon me, miss. May I?
Help yourself.
I'm Osgood Fielding the third.
Cinderella the second.
If there's one thing I admire, it's a girl with a shapely ankle.
Me too.
Bye-bye. Let me carry one of the instruments.
Oh, thank you. Aren't you a sweetheart?
Certainly is delightful having young blood around here.
Oh, well, personally, I'm type O.
You know, I've always been fascinated by show business.
Is that so?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's cost my family quite a bit of money.
Oh, you invest in shows?
Showgirls. I've been married 7 or 8 times.
You're not sure?
Mama's keeping score. Frankly, she's getting rather annoyed with me.
Wouldn't wonder.
So this year, when the George White scandals opened, she packed me off to Florida. Right now, she thinks I'm out there on my yacht. Deep sea fishing.
Sir.
Well, pull in your reel, Mr. Fielding. You're barking up the wrong fish.
If I promise not to be a naughty boy, how about dinner tonight?
I'm sorry, I'll be on the bandstand.
Oh, of course. Which of these instruments do you play?
Bull fiddle.
Oh, fascinating. Do you use a bow or do you just pluck it?
Most of the time, I slap it.
That is it. That is just perfection to me. I love the comedic sense of timing between the two. I love exploring you know, probably his first time being hit on by a guy. Right. Like, how do you manage this and keep your sanity? You're just trying to get upstairs.
He handles it well.
He does. He does. It takes no no business. I overall really enjoy this film. It has one of the greatest final endings of maybe all time. Yeah. Debatable. Do you put this film
in the final line?
Final line. Yes. 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 Do you put this film in the top 100 comedies? Well, I know Billy Wilder said that it's subjective, and he didn't want to buy into it being like the best. He said maybe it's one of the best, but where do you rank it?
Yeah, I don't know. Whenever you say something's the best, it kind of is weird, but I mean, it's certainly one of the best. I think there's no question as a comedy, as a Hollywood comedy, it's one of the very best. You mentioned the last line,
yes,
which
sir.
Is, you know, nobody's perfect. I don't know. Do we need to set up the?
We can.
It's Joey Brown is so tenacious about hooking up and marrying Jack Lemmon,
yeah.
And they're making their escape in the end, and he just won't take no for an answer. And everything that Jack Lemmon says to try to turn him off to the idea, he says, you know, I can't have kids. We'll adopt. You know,
yeah.
I'm not a real blonde. Doesn't matter. One thing after another. And finally, he takes off his wig. He says, I'm a man. And Joey Brown says, well, nobody's perfect. Now, the interesting thing about that line, which is maybe the most famous closer in movie comedy history, is that here you have Billy Wilder and I.L. Diamond, two of the greatest comedy minds in Hollywood history, and they couldn't figure out a way to close out the movie. So I don't know whose line it was. I think it might have been Diamond's, but he said, well, let's just say, have him say nobody's perfect. You know, we'll film it, and then we'll come up with something better. And they previewed it in, I think it was San Francisco. And, you know, the rest is history. So the point is, you never know. I mean, here you have these comic geniuses who couldn't themselves recognize that this was a great line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think whenever these things happen in movies, you know, it's absolutely, they know exactly what they're doing. You know,
yeah.
Who would know better? And no.
It's an amazing last line. It kind of sums up everything we've learned about human beings throughout the film. But I totally understand as a creative, you know, something sounds too simple, you tend to question it. How good can this be?
Right.
But it was the perfect ending.
I think it's even in Billy Wilder's tombstone.
Really?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Nobody's
check
perfect.
That out. But I,
wow.
Yeah, the notion that that everybody knows what they're... It was the same thing with Casablanca, by the way. They didn't know up until pretty much the day they filmed that ending that that's how they were going to end the movie.
No. You're just looking
you
at
know,
you,
this
kid?
This is the start of A Beautiful Friendship, Louis.
Oh, that one. Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
Again, simple line, but encompasses
totally.
Everything that we've just learned
yeah.
about human beings. Amazing.
My colleague Anthony Lane, who's a film critic at The New Yorker, called his collection Nobody's Perfect.
Aww.
That's really sweet.
Unlike my book.
I was going to say.
Yes.
Which is Rainer on Film.
Which
that's
is amazing.
Much more prosaic title, but there you go.
It's so good. If you guys haven't seen the earlier episode where Richard reads about Marlon Brando, that essay is transformative. It's beautiful. You definitely, definitely want to check out his book, Rainer on Film. We want to thank Peter Rainer for joining us here again. It was so wonderful to have you. And
there's so much more we could say.
I know.
Yeah.
Keep talking.
If you haven't watched the movie, you just should. It's just a belly full of laughs. Like, it is timeless and so great. And you'll see great performances and one of the best directors of all time at work. Thank you so much for breaking down the history.
You're very
and
welcome.
Giving us an insight. Guys, thank you so much for joining us once again. We'll be back here next week, 4:00 sharp for next class. We'll see you guys then.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.